Name is Kevin Stockstill, and I represent appellant Teresa Thayall. Your Honor, there are three issues that were presented by this appeal. One was whether or not gambling evidence that was introduced by the government was in violation of Code of Evidence Article 404B. The second issue was whether or not there was sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction. And the third issue was whether or not the district judge's restitution order was proper. I did not appeal that third issue. I only appealed the 404B issue and the sufficiency issue. So my argument this afternoon relates to those two issues. A brief recitation of the facts. Mr. and Mrs. Thayall owned a business by the name of Acadiana Patio Systems. That business ended up filing bankruptcy, and both Mr. and Mrs. Thayall had personally guaranteed the majority of the debts of that business. And so when that business went into bankruptcy, in effect, forced them to go into bankruptcy as well. 4 months prior to them filing their bankruptcy, they had sold a piece of property that at one time had housed the business. And the sale of that property was for $100,000. They received $85,000 in cash, and they received the promissory note. And so 4 months later, when they went to file their bankruptcy petition, they failed to disclose the fact that that property had been sold and that they had obtained a promissory note in addition to the cash for the sale of that property. And so the issue that was before the jury in this matter was whether or not that failure to disclose, was that intentional, was it knowingly and fraudulently done, or was it simply a mistake? And of course, we took the position that it was just a mistake. What the government did in that case was, in order to try and establish that the false statement in the bankruptcy petition and the schedules was knowing and fraudulent, they brought in evidence, sufficient evidence or substantial evidence of Mr. Thayall's gambling. In their closing argument, they stressed the fact that Mr. Thayall had lost hundreds of thousands of dollars gambling, that some of the money that was obtained by the sale of the property was used to gamble. They also brought out that the night before the bankruptcy was actually filed, there was evidence that Mr. Thayall was gambling. And so we objected. We filed a motion in limine to try and prevent that evidence from coming in. We objected at the time that it came in to the trial that it was in violation of Rule 404B, and it was also in violation of Rule 403, and that the prejudice that was associated with this gambling evidence was highly prejudicial and greatly outweighed the probative value of that evidence. As this court stated in the Sumlin case, the purpose of Rule 404B is to guard against the inherent danger that the admission of other crimes evidence might lead a jury to convict a defendant, not of the charged offense, but instead of an extrinsic offense. And our position is, and we believe that that's exactly what happened in this case, that the jury was somewhat poisoned and prejudiced by this gambling evidence. I know that gambling is legal, and the district court had pointed that out. And gambling in and of itself may not inflame a jury, but we believe that to include evidence of gambling and coupled with the fact that these people were filing bankruptcy and were experiencing financial hardship, that the combination of you going and gamble with the fact that you were having financial problems would inflame the jury and ran a substantial risk of the jury relying on that evidence to reach a conviction in this case, as opposed to the other evidence that was introduced by the government. The government argues that the gambling evidence was intrinsic to the offense charged, and because it was intrinsic, 404B does not apply. However, as we pointed out in our brief, the money that was obtained from the sale of the property and it being used as gambling in no way would have affected the bankruptcy proceeding. It would not have been brought back into the bankruptcy proceeding. It was not a prohibited transaction. It was not a transaction to an insider. It was not paying an antecedent debt 90 days prior to the filing of the bankruptcy. And so since it wasn't, it really wasn't relevant. It wasn't part of the bankruptcy estate. There was no motive or intent to hide that evidence because it wasn't part of the estate. And for that reason, we argue that it was not intrinsic, that it was extrinsic evidence.
But if it was still there, it would have been part of the estate? I mean,
no,
if they had not sold the property?
No. Well, had they not sold the property, would the property have been part of the estate? I believe that the property would have been part of the estate. The proceeds from the sale of the property, however, were not, and the transaction with the casino would not have been part of the estate. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Hudspeth.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I represent the appellant Thad Thayall, husband to Mrs. Teresa Thayall, and I join Mr. Stockstill in his argument to this court about the fact that the government's having interlaced this entire trial with all sorts of evidence of Mr. Thayall's bankruptcy, of Mr. Thayall's gambling activities and losses, even a year before the bankruptcy, and then certainly up until the evening before the bankruptcy, was error under the federal rules of evidence, and was not harmless error. It had an adverse impact on the jury's verdict, and it was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
But
having said, yes,
was
sir.
Not illegal gambling, was it?
Gambling is not illegal, and we certainly, given that we lost on our motion in limine and all of our objections to every step of the way that evidence was actually introduced at trial with respect to gambling, at every point we objected. But at the end of the day, what we had to argue was that it was not illegal. And that was sort of the whole point in terms of its relevancy or lack thereof to the whole bankruptcy proceeding. Ms. Andrus, the trustee, said they could have gambled all of the proceeds of the sale away prior to the actual filing of the bankruptcy. That was not illegal. It couldn't have been undone or avoided. It was their money. They didn't have to pay creditors. But they did gamble, and the FBI went over check after check to the casino, none of which was concealed. There was nothing suspicious about the gambling, but they suggested it was suspicious, and at the end of the day, argued to the jury and their effort to get the jury to agree that it was fraudulent and not inadvertent, the failure to put the actual transaction on the petition, that he gambled up to the night of his filing for bankruptcy, and that's the sort of person he is in terms of judging this the failure to include in the bankruptcy petition the transaction. It's in essence an argument that he's of such a character because he likes to gamble and he does it unwisely at the worst time possible, when he needs money to pay creditors, that he's the sort of character that he would fraudulently and not inadvertently.
Would this go towards the issue of knowledge, of intent, that what they did with the money once they sold the property?
That was certainly an issue at trial. Our defense was not that the transaction shouldn't have been reported or the promissory note, but that its failure to do so was inadvertent. And we presented through the testimony of the Thayall's bankruptcy attorney the process by which the form was filled out and the problems with that process, and that's all in the record. So certainly you could argue inadvertence, but at the end of the day, the government was able to argue these are the sort of people who would go gamble, and if they would go gamble prior to filing for bankruptcy rather than using that money to pay off creditors, then they must be the sort of people who would fraudulently rather than inadvertently fail to record a transaction. And again, there was nothing about gambling in and of itself that was improper. And there was discussions about gambling through the bankruptcy creditors and or debtors meeting, that sort of thing. There was nothing, it was not concealed. But it became the theme, the beating drum of the government's case throughout, that this is how you decide if it was fraudulent or inadvertent. Look at the fact that Mr. Thayil is a serious gambler, and even had as the last witness they called on direct someone from the casino to say that Mr. Thayil had gambled up to $5,100 the night before the petition was filed. And that was not even money, clearly at that point, that came from the proceeds of the sale.
Did that make a difference, that there was some testimony or evidence that he gambled with some of the money from the sale, but then they went a step further and went into gambling debts that did not involve money from the proceeds of the sale? Is there a distinction to be made there?
It certainly tipped the boat, I believe, in our favor in terms of the irrelevancy and the prejudice to the jury's verdict. If, you know, you have to wonder, at what point could the government have stopped in their efforts to paint Mr. Thayil as this horrible person who gambles when he shouldn't? But they didn't stop. I could see what you're saying, Judge, that if they had stopped at saying he used, and there's evidence of this, approximately $20,000 of the proceeds, which was actually $79,000 after everybody was paid for the sale. He deposited $79,000 into his account, and the FBI agent testified that of that amount, within that month's period, which you could arguably trace to that $79,000, about $20,000 in checks was written to the casino. But they didn't stop there. They went on and talked about what he did even before the sale of the property and what he did with money that clearly had nothing to do with that transaction the evening before the petition was filed by Mr. Weinstein, his bankruptcy attorney. If there are no questions, I have just a little bit of time, and I do want to talk about the issue, the legal issue before the court, of whether or not this restitution order as a matter of de novo review is illegal. Of course, under the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act, the court has to order restitution if there's a victim who suffered a loss that's directly caused by the offense. In this case, the offense being the fraudulent failure to list the transaction and the promissory note. Clearly, the promissory note, as I understand bankruptcy law after this case and this trial, takes a snapshot of what your resources and debts look like the minute you file.
Just to get this clear, the offense is not that they sold the property illegally, but that they did not report it when they declared bankruptcy.
That's right, Your Honor. There's no question it was an arm's length transaction. There's nothing, that transaction would not have been avoided by the trustee. It was a legitimate transaction. They took the money, the trustee testified, and Mr. Weinstein said they could have gambled it away, they could have burned it like Mr. Norris did in the Norris case that we rely on. But they didn't. They gambled, admittedly, with some of it, but they also paid bills. They did all sorts of, you know, utility. I made the point on cross to the agent when after she listed all of the gambling checks to say these are the other checks that were paid. But getting to the restitution, because I'm almost out of time, there was no discharge in bankruptcy. One of the creditors' attorney, Mr. DeBayon, who had been a trustee on the case originally and had a conflict and withdrew, he appeared at the creditors here at the debtors' hearing. He questioned about this transaction because he represented someone who had worked in the building that was sold, and ultimately, through his insistence, this debtor was not, these debtors were not discharged in bankruptcy. And they, Mr. DeBion, on behalf of his clients, the Rockas, who testified at trial, was able to get a $100,000 default judgment against the Thayalls because they were not discharged in bankruptcy, because of his efforts. Because, as in Norris, a case we cite and rely upon, ultimately, to the extent you accept that this was a fraudulent false oath that was intentional, nobody believed it, ultimately. No one was fooled by it. They were caught, if you will. And Mr. DeBion and his clients made the decision that rather than have Ms. Andrus bring that $15,000 note, and there was a $1.6 million bankruptcy. So rather than have, let's share the $15,000 or even the $35,000 that was written to Mr. Thayall's company, essentially himself, Thad's Reynolds, from the $79,000, that rather than say, let's split that up, they wanted no discharge in bankruptcy. They got it. They got a judgment, as did many other creditors, and there was no harm, no foul, no proximate. There's been no loss and no proximate cause as a result of the failure to report these transactions in the bankruptcy petition.
Was Thank the you. Status of the bankruptcy estate as not being a victim asserted to the bankruptcy court?
We asserted it at the district court level. In the bankruptcy court, with Mr. DeBion, who's also acts as trustee in other cases, taking the lead for the creditors, the Rockas, he made the case that they should not be allowed to discharge in bankruptcy because even though he found it out subsequently in the bankruptcy, the transaction and the existence of the promissory note, he felt that they should not be allowed to be discharged. The bankruptcy trustee agreed with them, filed papers so as they couldn't be discharged, and ultimately the bankruptcy court issued an order that there was no discharge, and the Rockas, as well as many other creditors, went to their various district courts and got judgments against these folks, and they're still there.
Thank you.
Is the order that directed the payment of the $50,000 to the bankruptcy state still outstanding?
Yes, sir. The district court judge, as part of sentencing, ordered, there's no order in the bankruptcy court, but the district court judge in this case, as part of sentencing, ordered the Thayalls to pay into the bankruptcy estate, which has been closed because of no discharge, $50,000, which presumably, and an argument is it can't even be done under bankruptcy law, that the bankruptcy estate would be reopened. And what? Would this money be distributed? What about the creditors who've been paid? What about the creditor? Will our client then be discharged in bankruptcy if some of this money is distributed?
You have 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Domingue?
May it please the court, I'm Camille Domingue. I represent the United States, who's the appellee in this matter. The indictment in this case charged two counts against both defendants. And the charge was...
The second count was only after him?
No, they were both charged in both counts. She was only convicted on the first count, the false statements in the filing. She was acquitted on the count that had to do with the false statements at the creditors' meeting. But basically, the indictment charged two counts that had two components, a false statement that had the effect of concealing assets. So this was not merely a false statement for the sake of making a false statement case, but it was a false statement in order to conceal an asset. The first count was the making of a false statement in a filing about a transfer that should have been disclosed but was concealed. And the second count discussed the making of a false statement about the same transfer in the creditors' meeting, thereby concealing that asset. The district court recognized early on, there were a lot of pretrial conferences, a lot of motion practice in this case on the admissibility of many pieces of evidence, but of concern here is this gambling evidence, that the United States had the burden of proving not only that this false statement had been made, but that it had been made intentionally or knowingly and fraudulently. And fraudulently, as this court has defined it, means with the intent to deceive or cheat. And as you've heard counsel acknowledge, the entire defense at trial was that this was mistake, inadvertence, confusion regarding the very complicated bankruptcy law, and that nothing was done intentionally. So by the time we get to trial, the evidence about gambling is admitted for two different purposes. One of the early witnesses to testify for the United States was William Rocca. That's this individual who invested $100,000 in Mr. Thayall's company. Actually, the company was owned by both of them. It was a patio company, a company that made patio or that built patios. And Mr. Rocca also worked there, and he is can be a difficult man. I think that will be apparent to all of you, even from the cold record. And he, you know, basically on direct, testified in a sort of a coded way, never using the term gambling, not talking about any kind of gambling, but basically saying, you know, I was concerned that the money was not being used properly, and I started to question him about it, started to look into the books, and I was fired. On cross-examination, defense counsel tried to paint him as a disruptive, contentious employee, sort of to explain that that's why he was fired, and that was the basis of the problem between them. And the court, on redirect, accepted the government's argument that the defense had opened the door to testimony by Rocca that it was that some of it, at least, was about his concerns about Mr. Thayall's gambling. And the court allowed government counsel to ask just a few questions. You know, what was the problem? What were you concerned about? And Rocca testified that he believed Thayall was gambling away some of his $100,000 investment, and he went to the casino, followed him to the casino, and he confronted him about it. And after that, things went really downhill, and that is the first mention of gambling evidence by any witness in this case. Now, we get on later in the case, and the FBI agent begins to talk about the checks. Now, as I said before, the government has to prove the making of the false statement. We've alleged that this is done to conceal. And it's the government's theory that the way the transaction that wasn't reported, the sale of the APS building, was concealed was by spending. And one of the many ways that this money was spent was through gambling. I mean, it could have been something else. It could have been, you know, collecting antique thimbles, but it wasn't. It was gambling. It was spent many other ways. And there was a lot of testimony about all the different ways that this money was spent. A relatively small portion of it was about how it was spent on gambling. And the district court found, basically, that this evidence was not 404B. Defense counsel just characterized it as a 404B issue. From the government standpoint and the district court standpoint at a very early stage, this was not a 404B issue because it was intrinsic. This is the way these defendants concealed that which they had not disclosed on their bankruptcy schedules.
What about the evidence that was presented of gambling of money that did not come from the sale of this building? Why did we have to go, or why did the government go into these other gambling debts that had nothing to do with the money from the sale of this building?
Well, my first response to that would be that part was fairly limited, and I'll explain in a minute. There's a point in the trial where there's a lot of testimony from the FBI agent about this check to this person, this check to this person, this check to the casino. And we finally get to the point where defense counsel objects and says, wait, I think we've reached the $79,000 point. And the government's response was, well, there was some carryover because of the way the defendants moved the money around. In my brief, I go through a fair amount of detail, and I talk in footnote 4, I believe, about how, you know, money was used to pay off a credit card, but then a convenience check was immediately cut for the same amount, and this amount was sent here. So there was actually a rollover. So after we reached the $79,000, which is what they netted from the first part of the transfer, then there's actually a rollover of $17,000 that goes into the next month. So some of the gambling evidence that goes into the next month is traceable to the proceeds of the sale. So that's the first point. On the testimony about the money that was spent at the casino the night before they filed, by that time we probably used up the $79,000. Now we still have the promissory note that's hanging out there, but that won't be redeemed for another couple months. But there's a point that becomes relevant as to what the gambling money was spent for. In one of the creditors' meetings, the 314 examination, the creditors' meetings, there's in the first one, the trustee asks about a check to the casino that was written the night before, or that was, I think it actually cleared the bank the day after the filing, but it would have been written right before the filing. And the trustee is concerned about this because when you get within the 90-day window, then a lot more transfers and transactions can be avoided. So the trustee asks him about it at the first creditors meeting, and he says, well, you know, that was to repay a loan to my in-laws. Then a few minutes later, he says, wait, no, that's not right. That was to buy a car. It was to buy a car. Now, remember, the trustee does not have the check. All she has are the bank statements, and she doesn't know what that money's, where it's gone. So he says, oh, no, that was used to buy a car. So she says, I want the bill of sale for the car, and I want that check. She lists off a number of checks that she wants. And she holds open the creditors' meeting so they can revisit this issue. When they get to the next creditors' meeting, she says, you know, you said last time it was a loan from your parents. Then you said it was for a car, but it's not. It's to a casino. Well, what is this all about? And he says, you know, that was a marker. I had a debt at the casino that was a marker, and I went and I paid it off. And that's just not right. The government offered testimony at trial, and this was part of the testimony that they complain about from the casino employees. The government offered testimony at trial that this casino does not issue markers. Again, to demonstrate yet another false statement made by the defendant at the creditors' meeting, having to do with the nature of the gambling debt. You know, that it wasn't a marker, it wasn't a pre-existing debt. But that this was money, you know, new money that they just went out and spent. Again, I would suggest that that was the purpose for that, to specifically show the falsity of one of the statements at the creditors' meeting. I'll go ahead and move on, unless the court has other questions about this, about the gambling evidence. Oh, my last point on the gambling evidence is, the government's alternative argument is, even if it's inadmissible, which we don't believe it is, the error is harmless. This was about 5 days of testimony. The gambling references were scattered throughout, but they certainly did not overwhelm the trial. The FBI agent talked about gambling. Mr. Rockeye had that brief reference to gambling. There were two casino witnesses who talked about some things regarding gambling. But the overwhelming bulk of the evidence in this case was the testimony of the trustee, who was on the stand for an entire day, plus a portion of two other days, and then their bankruptcy attorney, Mr. Weinstein. That is the overwhelming bulk of the evidence in the case, talking about what wasn't on the schedules that should have been on the schedules. And then that aspect of the FBI case agent addressing checks to a whole lot of people and only a handful of them to the casino. So we would alternatively argue that even if there was error in admitting the evidence, it was certainly harmless. It was not prejudicial, as Judge Dennis, I believe, pointed out. This is casino gambling. It is legal. It is highly regulated. The defendant successfully brought out a lot of testimony that you can do a lot of things at a casino that have nothing to do with gambling. You can eat at a wonderful restaurant. There are shows and all kinds of things you can do at a casino. The casinos are regulated. And finally, the jury was questioned during voir dire as to whether they would hold it against someone who would go to a casino and spend money at a casino. So we would suggest this is certainly not prejudicial, and even if it's improper, it was harmless error. Now, moving into the restitution issue, the restitution statutes provide for the payment of restitution to a victim of the offense. And a victim is defined, of course, as any person or entity who either is harmed directly or proximately as a result of the defendant's conduct. Now, the defendants concede that if they are entitled to victim status as a matter of law, then without a doubt, that $15,000 promissory note should have been reported on the schedules. And so that's $15,000 that would have been available to the creditors. This is a $1.7 million bankruptcy. I'm not telling you anybody would have been made whole, but there is certainly a loss of some amount of money to some creditor. Now, the defendants argued in the district court, as they argue here, that where there's a discharge in bankruptcy, there's no victim because everybody's returned to the status quo ante, everybody's back where they started, and all of these defendants have the right to pursue collection, through whatever means they can, garnishments, judgments, liens, whatever they can do. One thing I do want to point out, and I may have misunderstood what Ms. Hudsmith said, but the Rockhaus judgment against the Fayols was obtained before bankruptcy. It is on the bankruptcy pleadings. The Rockhaus are listed as a creditor to the tune of $100,000 based on a default judgment they had. So the Rockhaus did not go and get their default judgment after the bankruptcy was already done. They were a creditor in bankruptcy. And that's why, and I may have just misunderstood what she said, but I did want to clarify that one point. So the defendants basically said, well, let's just everybody start back where we were initially. But the purpose of restitution is to put the parties not in the place they were when it all started, but in the place where they would be if the criminal activity had never occurred. So if the criminal activity had never occurred, and all of these transfers, all the $100,000 transfer, the $1,500 promissory note, all the profit, this was unencumbered property. So other than the attorney's fees and whatever they had, we're talking about $90,000 worth of profit here. If all of that would have been disclosed, then the trustee would have had the opportunity to determine whether any of those transactions were voidable, and certainly, if nothing else, that $15,000 promissory note would have been available for distribution to the creditors. So you can definitely point to an injury here that the creditors have suffered. You can't really say, well, let's just all go back where we started from. As the district court found, at this stage of the game, I mean, this bankruptcy petition was filed in 2005. This case was tried in 2011. By that time, many of these debts are barred by the statute of limitations. In Louisiana and perhaps, other places, whatever law might be applicable, some of these are very old debts. Not to mention, that would serve to shift the burden of collecting all of these debts to the creditors, who are the people who have been wronged in the bankruptcy. And it would essentially give the defendants a de facto discharge that they were denied because of their own criminal activity. So this would, really turn the whole concept of restitution on its head. Now, one of the principal arguments the defendants make, and it sort of underpins both their gambling relevancy argument and the restitution argument, is that the defendants could have spent this money any way they wanted to. We're really not talking about money that belonged to the estate. And that's just not accurate. It's correct that the money was not frozen or restrained. It was in their bank account, in their pocket, in their wallet. They could have spent it. But that's all assumes that all of the transfers have been properly disclosed to the trustee. So it's more correct to say they can spend it subject to full disclosure so that the trustee can determine whether any of the transactions, any of the transfers can be avoided. And of course they didn't disclose. So the trustee never had the opportunity to scrutinize any of them to see if they might have been avoided. And I would suggest, contrary to what counsel's argued, that a good chunk of those transfers could have been avoided. Maybe not all of them. For example, one of the things they spent it on was a mobile home that they used as their residence. Maybe, maybe not. That might not have been avoided. But there were transfers to Thad's Rentals. That's another company owned by the defendant. By definition, under the bankruptcy code, Thad's Rentals is an insider. Now, counsel argues that 547, 11 U.S.C. 547, doesn't apply because there wasn't a creditor relationship and an antecedent debt. Look at Government Exhibit 17, pages 22, 23, and 28. Fab Thayil testified at the second creditors meeting that he owed Thad's Rentals money, that he would borrow money from Thad's Rentals, but his CPA made sure that he would pay it back, that this was a debt that was owed by him to Thad's Rentals. Thad's Rentals was a creditor. I would suggest that 547, in terms of avoiding transfers, would apply. But even if 547 doesn't apply, as I've argued in my brief, 548 applies, because it would allow the trustee to avoid any transaction done to hinder, delay, defraud a creditor. And as part of the government's evidence proof, burden of proof in this case, it had to prove intent or fraudulent intent. So I would suggest that the jury found fraudulent intent. We had to prove it. They found it. 548 would apply, and that's the section under which the bankruptcy trustee could have possibly avoided any transaction to do with the entire $100,000. But I mean, at the very least, at the end of the day, we've got $15,000 that should have gone to the creditors. The bankruptcy estate, you know, the creditors suffered that loss because they were deprived of that. The last thing I'll talk about is to comment on counsel's argument that, as a matter of law, the bankruptcy could not, quote, be reopened, that because that there was a finding of no discharge, that this bankruptcy was closed and it's all over with. Well, what the district court did was basically find that the bankruptcy estate had been injured to the extent of $50,000. But said, you know, it's not the court's place to figure out who gets what. That's a matter of bankruptcy law. So I'm going to find that the victim, as representative of all the defrauded creditors, is the bankruptcy trustee. $50,000 payable to the trustee to be distributed to the creditors. And the court, quote, recommended, you will see that in the sentencing transcript and you'll see it in the judgment, recommended that the bankruptcy be reopened. I think it's a fair reading of the judgment and the transcript that the district court was not contemplating the reopening of the bankruptcy so that there could be a discharge. Again, that would reward the defendants for their criminal activity. The only thing that the district court's trying to do is get the trustee, who has a superior knowledge of bankruptcy law, to figure out under the bankruptcy rules, which I understand are very specific as to who gets what when we're dividing up a small pool of assets in a huge estate of debt, to let the bankruptcy trustee apply the rules. You know, as I understand it, you have unsecured creditors who are priority, non-priority, and it's all very explicit in the bankruptcy code. So when the district court says to the bankruptcy trustee to be dispersed according to bankruptcy law, what the district court is basically saying is apply the bankruptcy rules as to who gets what when we divide up this pie. The last thing I'll touch on briefly, I know I said the other was the last thing, but you know, you can't trust lawyers on things like that, is the Norris case, the applicability of the Norris case. Norris is distinguishable from this case because in Norris, no one believed the false statements from the get-go. In this case, it's clear in the record, the bankruptcy trustee testified that she initially filed a document that's basically a statement of no disclosure. Based on the Thayil's representations, which she took at their face value, subject to whatever little questions she had asked, she filed a document in the bankruptcy court representing that there were insufficient assets for distribution. It was after that that the attorney Ms. Hudspeth was talking about, Mr. DeBayon, filed a motion to expand the time in which to object to discharge, which allowed sufficient time for the Office of the U.S. Trustee to come in and to object to discharge. And that's exactly what happened. So this is a case in which, at the very least, the bankruptcy trustee, in this case, the Chapter 7 trustee, Ms. Andrus, believed the Thayil's misrepresentations, relied upon them in recommending no discharge. So this is clearly distinguishable from the Norris case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could address a few points made by the government. First would be that the government, it seems today and at this level, is arguing that the act of gambling was the way that they concealed the asset. I agree that that's what the issue is, that this is all about whether or not they were knowingly and fraudulently trying to conceal. But at the trial court level, the government's position was different. At the trial court level, when asked specifically by the trial judge, why is it that you are using this evidence, their response at the time was, because we want to show how the money was spent. Also, I believe concealing by gambling isn't factually accurate with the evidence that was presented in this case, because all of the evidence that the government submitted were checks that were written by the Thayalls out of personal accounts directly to the casino.
How was this argument used during final argument, the evidence of gambling? What kind of argument did the prosecutor make?
My recollection of the argument was the prosecutor was really honing in on the fact that the night before the bankruptcy was filed, there was gambling activity at the casino, and I think he used the phrase something to the effect of, well, that's how he operates. You know, that instead of paying his creditors, he's out gambling, and as Ms. Hudsmith said, it was basically, this is the type of person that he is, this is his character, this is who he is. You know, instead of paying money to creditors, he's out gambling, so therefore, certainly he's the type of person that would make a false statement in a bankruptcy petition, which is why we believe it was so terribly prejudicial in this case. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Starkstrom. Ms. Husband.
In the rebuttal, the government said, repeated that Mr. Thayalt lost $127,000 at a casino in 2003, which includes losses before the sale of this property, and said Mr. Thayalt gambled for almost 3 hours at a slot machine the day before he's filing bankruptcy. Quote, that shows you how he operates. That's how they used it, to show that he was the sort of bad person who would fraudulently commit this crime, the whole issue, which is improper under the federal rules of evidence. With respect to the restitution, the government is now saying if the bankruptcy is reopened, our client couldn't be discharged. So the windfall becomes to the creditors, if that is even possible under bankruptcy law. Because these creditors, including the Rocas, represented by Mr. DeBayon, have judgments. And it's in the record, the judgments that we had that were obtained against the client. It didn't matter when they were obtained. If this discharge had happened, the Rocas judgment would have been discharged. It wasn't, and it was because they were represented by an attorney who, like the people in Norris, were not persuaded or fooled, or did not detrimentally rely upon the failure to list it didn't work. The smartest thing our client could have done was to have listed that $15,000 promissory note and had that $100,000 judgment discharged. He didn't. The creditors should not get a windfall by having not only their judgment, but also their share, however Ms. Andrews could even do it at this point, of the $50,000 ordered paid into the bankruptcy court illegally. Thank you.
Thank you.